So, can we start with your thoughts on what do you think makes a good investor?
I think a good investor is situationally different. You really need to understand what it is you're trying to accomplish with, what are you trying to do? Maximize overall return over a long period of time, or if you're investing, running a portfolio. My fund, I get to make one investment in a company, and then when that company is done, I return the proceeds from that to my investors. So if I can make 50% on the investment in 6 months, that's a really good investment opportunity for most people. It's a bad investment for my fund. I'm supposed to do more than 50% return, and I'm guaranteeing a 50% return becomes a bad investment. So situationally, it can become different. But so understand what you're trying to accomplish, what your drivers are for the investment you're making at the time. As you grow through your life, your horizon changes too. Do you stay in equities when you think there's a potential downturn in the stock? If you're 60 and getting ready to use your retirement savings, you don't want to do that. You want to be a little more conservative. So, but taking, understand your situation, understand what you're trying to accomplish with the investment. But then when you look at investing in a particular company, whether it be public or private, early stage, late stage, I think it's important. And I think the best investors are, in some ways, 3D chess players, very strategic. It's one thing that a company can create market share right now in the current environment, but what are the potential challenges down the road? Now, if you're only investing for a short period of time, 6 months, a year, 2 years, you can think less about that. But as a venture capital investor, if I'm looking at a company that has interesting traction, starting to get some customers, but I know there's a monumental change to that marketplace coming up. You have to be careful. Can this company adapt, or will the new players or the new circumstances crush it? For example, if you're investing in a company that's making lithium ion batteries, and you know that the lithium supply is about to dwindle. I'm just making this up. I don't have any knowledge of lithium shortages, but there are risks you have to think about for their entire supply chain. Can they continue doing it? Or is there someone out there making a different battery format that will be cheaper, more reliable, more robust, and it's coming in 2 years? You better be ready to understand what the longevity of your investment is. So there are multiple factors that impact companies, and you have to be ready for them. At one point in my career, I was working in the fluorocarbon industry. We were making refrigerants. And the Montreal Protocol said that by a certain time, you could not make CFC-12, which was the original Freon. So our strategy was to decommission our Freon plants. Freon was a trade name of our competitor, so our CFC-12 plants. And as time went on, everybody else decommissioned their plants. We had the last one running. And there was a need for that product. So something that we thought was going to be worthless ended up making us millions of dollars because we were the last manufacturer of it. At one point in time, you didn't want to be making buggy whips, but you probably did okay if you were the last one making them because there were people who held on. So there's a lot of different issues that can change your perspective on a company that really isn't core to that company. And if you're not thinking beyond just that company, I don't think you'll do as well.
But partly, I mean, those things are like, sometimes those things are out of your control, right? By out of your control, I mean, like, it's very difficult to kind of predict those things, or like, to go back to your lithium ion example, right? Like, it's very difficult to like play arbitrage on that information. Like, since, I don't know, maybe it's not public, or like very few people can probably see it. Is that fair? Or
that's fair. But if you're not thinking about those potential issues and those risks, you're not going to be a great investor. And the one thing I see a lot of people, there's a limited number of investment opportunities for them. Well, there are so many investment opportunities for almost everybody short of BlackRock that you can say, if there's a question to one of them, you can move on to the next one. There's internally in my team, we have this, it's not the best slogan, but if you can't say hell yeah, it's a no. So there are plenty of investment opportunities. Find one that you're not worried about potential risks down the road, or you don't think that company is prepared to really take advantage of the disruption when that risk hits, if that risk hits. So investing in early stage companies, there's a lot of, especially very early stage companies, you're investing in the team. You're investing in, in many cases, it's a group of people that are passionate about solving a major issue for the world, for them, for a segment of the world, or, they just have an opportunity to make a lot of money. There aren't a lot of companies that I can name that are brand name, huge companies that are doing, making their money exactly with what they started as. Amazon sells books, yes. Amazon does not make a lot of money selling books. They were, Bezos was creative, took advantage of opportunities because he's flexible. He's a learner. He's very inquisitive. He's always looking for opportunities. If I'm talking to a company and they're very closed-minded about, we've created the best mousetrap or whatever they've created, and if customers don't think it's great idea, it's great, then they think their customer's stupid. Those are bad teams. They're not going to adapt to the lithium supply chain crunch or whatever the disruption is in their world.
You should be flexible to it's important to be flexible in your execution, or in the sense, like, once you get market feedback, it's important to take that feedback and not be adamant. If nothing is happening, it's dangerous to be adamant in your own in your own echo chamber. Is it?
Well, to your point a minute ago, it's tough to really know all the time that these disruptions could be coming, because it could be private. Someone could be running in stealth mode. Great. As an investor, yeah, I'm going to miss some of those, but the team I invested in, that company, better know their industry and what's, the threats to it that are coming up, and be ready to react to them. They may be a surprise, but they shouldn't be a total surprise that they never saw anything like that possibly coming, or have any idea what they were going to do if it did. So part of understanding, strategically all of the different things that could impact it. Also, you need to work with the team long enough to understand that they're adaptive, they're bright, they're strategic, and they're planning for it. Things won't come out of the blue to them.
I feel like the feedback loop of once you make an investment, to figure out, so I'm kind of conflicted about this, maybe you can clarify, in the sense that I'm trying to understand, if I can contrast this to, let's say, a medical example, where the result of the surgery, if somebody undergoes a surgery, and if, let's say, the doctor performs that operation, the feedback loop is, I feel it's kind of instant in some cases, at least, where, I don't know, if it's a heart surgery, the doctor performs the surgery, and then in a few hours or in a few days, you figure out if the surgery is successful or no. I may be off on the precise, like the particular example, but in theory, I'm saying. But in investments, I'm not sure if that is true, in the sense that if you pass on an investment today, maybe the company will do well 5 years from now, or maybe they will, soon after that investment round closes, it may start getting traction and do really well. So what is your thinking on like feedback loop? Do you get like quick feedback that this company is doing well, or does it take like a long time before you realize what you made was a mistake or what you passed on was a mistake?
Generally, it takes a few years. Our investment horizon, especially in early stage companies, I'm expecting to know if I did well in 6, 7, 8 years. I can guarantee you that I will pass on some great, great companies that I should have invested in. I'm certain of that. But the art is to be correct enough. The trick with especially early stage is your mistakes of omission, you'll know them. They become very public, and will significantly harm your returns. I often tell people that if 15 years ago someone came into my office and convinced me that hitchhiking over the internet was a good idea, now, two things that I was raised to not do: get in a car with strangers, or meet people over the internet. Well, I wasn't brought up not meeting people over the internet, since there wasn't an internet, but be aware of strangers. Okay, someone was pitching that. And if you convince that person it was a good idea, but then they balked because, hey, the valuation, they wanted, I think their seed round, they valued the company at 5 million or 5.5 million. If you thought it was only 3 million, and so you passed, you feel horrible right now. But I think you're more likely to have said, no one's going to get in a car with a stranger that they connected with on the internet. No one's going to want people to sleep in their bedroom, their spare bedroom, and rent out their house. But the truly successful investments are going to be major disruptors like Airbnb and Uber. And, Apple created a nice computer. They had a nice business, and then they kind of floundered because it was the art community and the creative community was using them, but business people were using IBMs or IBM based, Windows based. And then they had this idea to put a phone, a listening device, a communication device in your hand, and now they're one of the most valuable companies ever. So it was a great investment early, and then it seemed like an okay investment, and then it became an amazing investment. So things change. The disruptions happen. I was talking to a company yesterday. I was given the opportunity to invest in them 4 years ago. I thought what they were doing was crazy. I was given the opportunity to invest in them 2.5 years ago. They were changing their original investment, original business model, to something that I thought was a little better, but still not something I really wanted to invest in. I was talking to the CEO yesterday, and they're getting acquired, and they're going to make, I would have made 25 times my money in 2.5 years. He was very kind and said that he thinks they're getting purchased for more than he would have ever imagined 2.5 years ago also. So he gets that, he understands why I passed, but it does hurt a little bit that I left that kind of money on the table.
Like on the losses part, by loss, I mean the investments that you passed and like the story that you just told me about how it sold for like 25x your money, the amount of money that you'd have made. Does it like bother you? Not like, like once in 15 days or once in like 2 weeks, does it like come to your mind, like any significant investments that you passed on and you're like, oh my God, I should not have done it? Is it like a constant thing that you have to fight mentally, or?
It's something that you want to keep in the back of your mind, because your overall success of a portfolio is going to be driven by the one or two best investments you make. There was a goofy little sitcom that HBO produced a few years ago called Silicon Valley. And there was a woman in there that was a venture capitalist. And she would often say, I passed on Slack. She passed on an opportunity to invest in Slack, which would have made a lot of money. And almost seemed like every episode she said that. I don't say that it bothers me constantly, but it's something you think about when you're getting ready to, if you're ultimately getting ready to pass on a deal, you have to think about, well, what could really drive this to be outstanding? And it gets back to the hell yeah motto. I don't want to invest in companies that I think this will be a nice return, because that's going to take a spot out of my portfolio that could have been 25x or 1,000x, like Uber was. Actually, that I think was more than that. So you have to be careful that you don't try and just get little nice wins. This business requires swinging for the fences.
Oh, okay. I mean, in the sense that if tomorrow somebody pitches you an amazing business and, you know, you feel like this is going to grow significantly, but it's not going to be like huge, like, I don't know, like Hyundai or something like that, you will still, I mean, obviously everything's subjective, but broadly you're really swinging it. Is it not like like a decent business, but may not make a lot of money?
Well, you know, back to the original question, what are the parameters? What are you trying to deliver? In my business, I'm trying to deliver a very strong portfolio. So we, in our business, in my particular fund, I invest in seed stage companies, Series A, Series B, Series C. And for those that aren't in the venture capital world or startup world, seed investments, first time they're taking professional money. They're, you know, they've been funding it on their own, or got some friends or some angel investors, and they got to this point and it's time to bring in money to really start growing the business. Series A is usually they have some revenue and they're starting to grow. Later are just other steps along the way. For a seed investment, if you just threw darts at a list of seed stage investments that were made by at a venture capital fund investing, somewhere on the order of 66% of them fail. Series A, around 50%, Series B, 40% later. And as you get later on, it gets close to, 10-25%. So
actually I feel like till now I think I've heard the number as 90% of all startups fail, but I feel like 66 is still okay. Is that fair, or I don't know? Am I being too optimistic?
Well, 90% is, well, I think ultimately 100% fail. It's just what's your timeline? And what's your definition of fail? When I talk about seed, I clarified that with venture-backed seed stage deals. So I think the 90% number is entrepreneurs that start off and does their business return money to their investors? 90% of them don't. Well, a big chunk of that group never get venture capital money and fail because they never got to the point where it made sense. Or they were in an industry that, or for personal reasons, they didn't raise money from venture capital. I'm just looking at the universe of venture capital backed companies. So, in theory, there's a professional making the decision to write a check into that company. And there, you still get 2/3 failure just because things happen. And failure is generally defined as the investors lost money at the end of the day. So when I'm looking at, okay, 2/3 of them are going to fail, and I'm going to put 8 to 10 of those in my portfolio, I need to realistically see a path for that company to make at least 25 times my investment. Because I've got to offset the ones that don't make it. Now, I'm doing a little better than just throwing darts at a venture capital backed. So I'm doing a little better than that, but so far, things happen. But I want to realistically think it could deliver 25x or more. Series A, I want to see 15x possible. Series D, Series E, those used to be IPOs. So the upside is a little smaller, but the risk is significantly lower. In those cases, I have to see the opportunity for around 5x at least with very limited risk. But I don't want to have too many investments like that lock me in to, if the best I can do is 3, 4, 5x, which is all nice for my investors, but you do want to have the opportunity to really blow it out of the park and have a much higher return.
In that sense, is it fair to say that early, seed stage might be the most difficult, at least when you compare it to ABC and so on, it's the most difficult one? Is it fair, or do you think?
It's more subjective. In some ways, I look at a seed investment as an easier project for myself because there's so little to look at. The industry, they tell you what industry they're trying to get into and what their business model is. And they may have a product. They may still be developing the product. They have the core of their team. They may have some customers. I don't have to look at that for all that long. Because there's not that much to look at. There was a company that was pitching me a business. They were making an app that had a very specific marketplace. And the two biggest players in that marketplace had their own. So they were trying to get everybody else. If things went really well for them, they could have $10 million in sales annually. All right, they're valuing themselves when they're selling this round of stock at $2 million. So there's a chance for a 5x return if they get every possible customer. Okay, that market's not big enough. I don't have to look at that seed investment very long. Or there's something wrong with the team. I don't have to look at it very long. It's in some ways easier to analyze those because there's so little information. And as an investor in the space, you have a pretty good idea of things that are going on in the market. So that piece of diligence is kind of innate because of repetition from looking at many companies in the space. So it's really just, is this product, does the business model make sense? Can it actually deliver them money without them completely dominating a market? Because startups rarely dominate a market. So the evaluation process doesn't really take as long. Series A, Series B, more things are going on.
The thing that you said for you makes it makes it very easy is the thing that scares me the most. Like, obviously I'm not an investor, but that is the kind of thing that would probably even scare me into getting into this field, in the sense that there is so little information that I would probably like be so scared of like making a decision based on like so little information that I would never have that courage to I can't make any decision now. So I think that's a personality thing. I don't know. Maybe you just have that courage, or
I don't know if it's courage. You start to understand the math, and the fact that this the company that could only make 5x, you throw that out right away because the market they're going after just isn't big enough. Let's say a company is created the next generation of a smartphone. There's a huge market opportunity. So I don't have to think about whether there's a big enough market, whether people are going to buy, people will buy smartphones. We know that. Now the question is, do they have something that will differentiate them between Apple and Samsung and everybody else who controls that market? Why will people buy this particular phone? Now, because that market's so big, you don't have to get a big percentage of that to be a really successful company. So each industry is a little different, but they're very common things. And it's like every industry, every job, every career. I'm a basketball fan, and I work with two people who played professionally. And we get into conversations about basketball. I found this video last year of NBA defenses and how they hide bad defenders. So in this situation, in this move, when the offense does this, the defense is going to do this. But if it's actually the wrong person there, the defense has, and I'm thinking from the time I casually played basketball, how would I think? There's no way you could think through all that. But then you watch a game and you understand what they're trying to do, and they do it like instinct, because that's their career. They're professionals at it. Some of the things that I understand about my business and investing in certain markets, I don't have to think about very long because I think about it 24/7. Every business, every career has things that just innate to them. I've said this to a few pilots, they don't like it, but my dad was a truck driver. And I would argue that 98% of the time, a bus driver or a truck driver have a much tougher job than an airline pilot. However, those 2%, I really want the airline pilot if I'm in the air and something's going not right. That's what they get paid for. They train to know what happens when this, what do you do when this happens? And sometimes it's not what you would normally do. You have to do the opposite. And, but a bus driver is constantly being, traffic, kid running in front of the bus, someone yelling at you from behind, people fight, whatever's going on that bus is more hectic than cruising at 35,000 feet. But the people who are driving the buses are trained to deal with those reactions. The people who are flying the planes are trained for different things. So it's, I understand if you're not an investor, and certainly if you're not an early stage investor, that some of these things, wow, how can you, it's just kind of what we do every day. And it becomes second nature. So you got to be careful to not make it too much second nature, because you don't want to make stupid assumptions like people shouldn't be hitchhiking off the internet because, oh, wait, that is a really good idea.
You can touch on this, but in the sense that we spoke about swinging for the fences while maybe making an investment, I'm curious in the sense that, do you have a personal desire of investing in the next Facebook? I feel like part of me feels like, obviously, yeah, I wouldn't think anybody would not want to invest in the, but I feel some people are okay with making they don't think about investing in the next Facebook, but they just think about making good investments and think about I want to invest in the next Google, that doesn't motivate them so much. How do you think about that?
My job is to make money for my investors. So I want to make the best investments that are available to me. I also want to be able to feel good about myself. So right now, I'm not sure I would want to tell people I invested in Facebook. There's some issues with that. You've made a lot of money, but it's,
I'm so sorry. But when you said that, the way I interpreted that was, you know, you get some status by saying that I invested in Facebook, Google. Like, you know, sometimes people in their bio or when they promote their website say, you know, we were the first investors in like Facebook or Slack, for example. So I thought you were going that route, but you like, you were like, no, I'm not proud of doing that investment. Okay.
If I had been the first investor in Facebook, I'd tell you. I have a company I invested in 6 years ago. They just finished a phase 1 clinical trial for a functional cure for HIV. There are 5 people walking around today that pretty much been cured from HIV because they went through that trial. They aren't officially cured, but there are enough signs of efficacy that they've experienced that they're in a lot better shape than they were before they did it. The company's going to do a phase 2. Signs are very strong that they'll have a cure for HIV. I'll make a decent amount of money from that investment, but I'll be really proud I did it. Invested in a company that is looking for ways to help people who struggle. Many economies, it's really tough to survive without a credit card. In many situations, you can't get one. You know, there are people who really struggle to get one. And this company is trying to create a path to that so that people who are struggling can be a little easier for them.
Even though I nodded, I'm so sorry, even though I nodded, I actually couldn't relate to that because, I'm from India, I'm from Bangalore, India. So in India, I think the credit card penetration is, if I'm not wrong, 25%, 30%, definitely below 40%. So yeah, but I guess it's not in the US.
But those 40% are, their lives a lot easier, isn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah. So the aspirations of those other 60, 70% to have one is fairly strong. So I think that there are a number of investments we've made that no one will care about ever, and I'll make some money. Nice. There are companies that will significantly change people's lives, and I'm going to make a lot of money. I feel better about those. I joked about Facebook. There are some great things that have occurred because of Facebook, and then there are some things that I think the world would be better off if we didn't have. But all in all, Facebook has been an improvement. People stay in touch a lot more. There are some negative things that come with that, but yeah, I also get opportunities to invest in gambling apps. You might make some money, but are you improving a lot of lives that way? I'm not a social impact fund, but on some levels, I want to make sure that what I'm supporting is something that I want to see flourish. There are a number of things that there are people who really want, there are people who gambling is important to them and it improves their lives. I think there are enough negatives to it that I want to kind of stay away. So you got to balance all that stuff out.
Like even though your fund may not be a social impact fund, I think effectively it is at this point.
It's not officially. It is not. I make some investments that have absolutely nothing to do with social impact. My fund is never a lead investor. We're a follow-on investor, so there has to be another venture capital fund investing before we can participate. It's just one of the rules we set and the way we operate. And someone recently pointed out to me that I have my last fund only had 40% of the founders were white guys, which in the US venture capital, like 4% of the money or less goes to women founded companies and 2% or less go to people of color. Add those two categories together, I'm around 55, 60% of my are from founders in those two demographics. And people are like, what? Is this intentional? Like, it's not intentional, but it's understanding statistics. if so little money goes to those backgrounds, the people who already have been able to fight through that and actually raise money from another venture capital fund, there's something about them I should pay attention to. So I look closely at those and end up have invested in quite a few of them because statistically they actually do deliver better returns than the average of venture capital.
In terms of like, just want to push this in the sense that, so do you think there is any correlation between morality by like, I won't define morality per se in the sense that, so one is like not investing in, let's say, gambling or let's say liquor or let's say any kind of activity. Yeah,
I mean, investing in a liquor company.
Oh, okay. But if we make this like a general case in the sense that I don't know if there is there any correlation that you see that not investing in such companies and doing extremely well, or the other aspect is being morally corrupt. By that I mean you may invest in all the right companies, but you may be morally corrupt. It's a vague term, but you can interpret it as you want. And being extremely successful, do you think there is any correlation in that sense, or maybe negative correlation?
It's tough. Morality is very much a sliding scale. One person's immoral act is the next person's desired state of being. So I don't want to get too far on, a preachy side of morality, because some things that I consider very moral, others might consider very immoral. I don't know that there's a correlation. The cartels of Mexico are very financially successful. I don't know that they do many things in their day-to-day operation that I would consider morally positive. But right now, they're helping a lot of people come from areas they don't want to live in, getting them to the United States to live in areas that they want to live in. Morally, that is a very positive thing for a lot of people. Now, there are some people in the U.S. that would consider that completely immoral, but even something like a Mexican drug cartel does do some things that on certain scales are moral. They're from a purely investment return standpoint, investing in a Mexican drug cartel would probably have been very lucrative. I would find it morally abhorrent, but so I don't know that there's a correlation. During Prohibition, in the US, people who made illegal alcohol did very well. And it was considered extremely immoral. There was a time when you may not remember the format wars of VHS and Betamax. So when I was growing up and early adulthood, you could all of a sudden VCRs appeared and you could tape TV shows and watch them later, or you could buy a movie and watch it. And there were two major formats. One was called VHS and the other was called Betamax. Sony made Betamax. VHS was made by a number of other companies. The story I've heard, I haven't done a lot of research on this, was VHS became the predominant format. And the general story is Betamax refused to allow the pornography industry to produce tapes on Betamax, and VHS took off because of the pornography industry. To many people, very immoral, very successful as an investment. And I've seen a number of cases where sex, pornography, by many standards, immoral, have been major drivers of innovation change. So I don't think there's a correlation. There have been studies recently that companies that focus on sustainability and governance, because they're so focused on critical issues, tend to perform better than their peers. I don't know. I wasn't part of those studies. I haven't read too much. Just kind of read the highlights of that once. There may be flaws in that, but there have been correlations showing that moral investing has a positive correlation. But I can show you, I've just shown you several where immoral to many investing would have done very well as well. So I don't know there's a correlation. But I do want to, you know, I do want to, at the end of the day, be happy that the investments that I made not only made my investors money, but I feel good about many of the companies in there. So I'm not, if you're a drug cartel and you're starting to raise VC money, don't call me. I'm not interested.
In terms of, this is going back to the initial part of when you were talking about what makes a good investor. I'm talking about in general, and this may not be in terms of like venture capital or maybe even the way you do things. In terms of age, do you think people get less risk averse as they age, in the sense that the appetite for risk, do you think that decreases as you grow old?
I think you become more risk adverse. I mentioned earlier thinking about your retirement. You know, I have friends that are preparing. I have friends that are retired. I have friends that are preparing for retirement, and was just in a conversation with one that he's nervous about where the economy's headed right now, and the stock market could have a correction. So he's going to want to live off his retirement income sometime in the next. Well, he's announced he's retiring in 3 years. So in the next 3 to 5 years, he's going to want to be living off that money. So you don't want to be sitting in a risky stock market situation as he perceives it right now, because you need the money.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So risk averse means you're insensitive to risk, is it? Oh, I'm so sorry.
If you risk adverse means that you are, you take on more risky.
Oh, okay. Endeavor. Okay.
So he's taking money he's putting money in bonds and cash because he's not going to lose his principal because he wants to live off of it shortly. If my daughter, who's 30, says to me, "Dad, should I be worried about the stock market going down significantly because of something over the next 2 years and get my money out?" No, you should not. You're 30. You don't need that. You won't need that money until you're 60. And historically, stock markets outperform many other standard asset classes, even with the dips. So just keep it there. Don't try and time the market. You're not that worried about risk right now. But as you get older, I think your situation changes and you need to become a little more sensitive to risk. And I think there is a part of the human person that as they get older, they get a little bit less worried about things that they're doing. But from an investing standpoint, I think they become more less tolerant of taking on risky investments.
Uh-huh, okay. And do you think that only holds to investments, and or do you think that also carries over to like ideas as well, where maybe not very deceptive to like there might be some resistance towards like very new technologies or ideas where we used to do things in the old days, that mentality?
And I've noticed that people don't like change. So, I think my mom still believes the internet might not make it. It's a fad. She hasn't adopted the internet very much. And I think you know, there are definitely people when you give them a new piece of technology, the older they are, the less likely they are to adopt it. Someone who's 3, 4, 5 years old right now, their entire life, they're going to live with pretty good artificial intelligence. They're going to have in their hand for the rest of their lives a life coach or access to more information than you and I currently know. I don't know what that does to change their life. A little worried that their ability to actually research something becomes a little, that skill goes a little soft, but they won't avoid new things as much as older people, new technologies as much as older people inherently do. So that's definitely a sliding continuum. But you know, on the risk side, I think if you were 70 and as agile as you were in your 20s, you'd probably see more 70-year-old mountain climbers. But you see fewer of them because they can't do it. I don't think that the risk and the fear that you're facing is as, you know, is with what you're risking to give up becomes smaller. If you fall, if you're mountain climbing, you fall down a crevasse and you're never heard from again. And in your 20, you gave up 70, 80 years of life. If you're 80 and you do that, hey, I had a pretty good life. But, and so there's a little bit of that, but you're restricted by can't get there when you're 80. Some people I sure can, but.
In that sense, like, I don't know if you follow Warren Buffett or if you're like, if you keep a close, like, keep a close eye on him or something. But would you consider him, if you do, would you consider him like an outlier where, you know, I think even Charlie Munger as well, I think Charlie is like 98, if I'm not wrong, 98, 99. And they're still going strong. And, you know, I feel like they're still very passionate. And so any thoughts?
In what they do, they are, but I don't think they're mountain climbing. Those two are outliers on a number of levels in an extraordinarily good way. Warren Buffett, almost everything he did was extraordinarily risk averse. He invested, he made a living of a very, very good living, investing in things that were very solid. He just found ways to take advantage of something that was wrong in the marketplace in industries that weren't going away. He found a store in Omaha that it's a tremendous furniture store, and it just kept growing and growing and bringing in other facets because the management team was outstanding, and he recognized that over the, I'm not sure exactly when he invested in it, probably in the 60s, but for the foreseeable future, people were going to buy furniture and TVs and electronics and things for their home. People were just going to acquire. So not a huge risky market, found a team that could dominate that in a region, invested in, he was very late to a lot of technologies because he wanted it to be very settled before he got in. So extraordinarily risk averse for the success he has, I would say, especially in the investor world. But not a lot of people like him, certainly an outlier.
Yeah, I mean, I actually respect that so much, especially that technology point where in general, I feel like everybody wants to get on the next hot thing. And, they also want to say that, you know, I'm involved in this, maybe crypto or nuclear fission or whatever. But he seems to be so, in a sense that he says, I don't invest in things I don't understand. And it is so beautiful, hearing such things where everybody's just on the lookout for the next hot thing to kind of talk about and invest in.
Yeah, it's, you know, when people ask about, you know, when they're thinking about investing in my fund, you know, what's your theme this year? I said, my theme's the same as last year and the fund before that and the fund. Our theme is to be diverse across multiple industries and kind of mimic what's going on in venture capital, but also try to avoid bubbles. I told a few of my investors that the current fund I'm investing out of will probably invest less in artificial intelligence, companies that are just artificial intelligence than I did 3 years ago. One thing as a venture capitalist, I shouldn't be investing in a lot of industries my mom knows about. She's 96. If she knows about it, heard about it on the news, it's probably 3 years, 5 years too late for me to invest to make a lot of money. But right now, artificial intelligence companies are valued very highly compared to companies in other industries because there's so much excitement about it. 3-4 years ago, you could say the same thing about crypto. And if I were agnostic, if you gave venture capitalists free rein, they would invest in a lot of crypto or blockchain technologies 3-4 years ago. Right now, they would be investing in a lot of artificial intelligence because there is a lot of excitement and there could be a next, and artificial intelligence will be very transformative to us. But the great investments are sometimes tougher to find when there's this euphoria.
What brings you the most stress, do you think, in your job? I find your job very stressful in the sense, at least looking at it from the outside, like you're managing other people's money. And I feel like that's a huge responsibility. So I don't know. But on a day-to-day basis, like, what is the thing that you think brings you like the most stress?
I'm investing other people's money and I feel very responsible that I do a solid job of that. And I invest it the right way. I know that I'm going to invest in companies that fail. It's just the nature of this industry. I know that I'm going to pass on a 25x return. But it's stressful to me that I know those things are going to happen and I'm failing my investors in some way. But I offset that with investing in an intelligent manner, very formulaic, so that I minimize the mistakes on both ends as best I can, while still taking the shot at potential big returns. So, you know, when I invested in the company that with the HIV cure 6 years ago, it was a great team that had some technology that looked very promising. They had some backers who, you know, other investors who really understood the space. There was a very high likelihood it could, and there's a high likelihood it could still fail. Drug discovery is very, until it's done, it's not done. And actually, until the check's in my investors' hands, it's not done. But you know, I took that shot because there was enough there to justify it in my mind and in what I do to offset that stress of investing someone else's money.
I thought you would say, I thought you would be like, some company is not performing well or maybe is going bankrupt and you're like kind of stressed about that, but it's mostly the responsibility part that is like,
I explain to people when they're thinking of, you know, our investors are all individuals and in many cases this is their first exposure to venture capital, so I try to explain to all of them that it is not the right investment for some people. I find out that a company is headed in a direction where they're going under, it hurts. I feel horrible about it. That's and that's not ever going to change. I get past it because I know that the way the math of venture capital works, my investors will be okay. I did the right things. We'll get through it. But I feel bad that I made that mistake or something happened. And sometimes it wasn't a mistake, just something happened. I invested in a company with a tremendous founder for that industry. Just he had had a very successful startup prior. And a year after we made the investment, there was a horrible accident and he died. I can't control that. He was doing something that was, you know, it wasn't like he was climbing a mountain. He was out on a boat and something happened and he died.
I did not see that coming, actually. I thought you would say there was a competitor who acquired them or they went bankrupt. I did not see that coming.
So, yeah. And as much diligence as I'd like to do on a company to make a safe investment for my investors, you don't see that coming. That company actually didn't fail. The co-founder took over and has done really well, and I think the company will be okay. But things happen. So I recognize that I'm going to do my best to make the right decisions putting the portfolio together. But I also know over the next 10 years, weird things will happen. I know companies will fail. I can help them as much as I, you know, to a certain extent, but if a better competitor came or a market shifted in such a way, there's nothing you really can do. The company is going to go under. And the way venture capital works, I'm investing in a security. I can't sell it. I can't salvage 50 cents on the dollar. I can't salvage 10 cents on the dollar. I just get what happens. And sometimes that is zero. And that psychologically to some investors in my fund, they can't. So I try and talk them out of investing in the fund because the negative one or two, three, four deals that fail bother them so much compared to the company that made 15x and 25x that meant that their original investment grew and they made decent, you know, a very nice return. But that the negative implication of that one event is just so psychologically damaging that they don't enjoy the wins. And they're Tversky and Kamen, you know, two of the behavioral economists that won the Nobel Prize. A couple of their studies showed that people, no matter how risk averse or risk tolerant people are, when you get them to make a decision, we all tend to make the decision that has less negative versus more positive, even if that decision hurts us in the long run, statistically.
I think it's called loss aversion, I think.
Yes. That's one of the studies that they did. But yeah, we don't inherently factor in statistics in our initial reactions to things.
We are scared to lose out on the things that we have more than the gain that would come from a new thing that we do not have yet. I think that, I don't know. I remember reading that.
I always remember my father-in-law before he passed was giving all of his daughters $10,000 in one stock. And they got to work with his advisor on what the one stock was. And so the advisor brought in the daughter and her husband, and one of the cases me. It's like, so what's your risk tolerance on this investment? Like on $10,000 of something I don't have today, pretty high. I don't look at it as I'm losing anything if it goes to zero because I don't have it now. So he looked at me like, wow, that's really strange. I'm like, it's not my money. And actually it's her money anyway, but she felt the same way. It's $10,000 is not a small sum of money, but it's also not a life-changing sum of money. And but to lose something that you didn't have,
put
me in a risky stock. I'd like to make more money.
But in that sense, like, would you say that, I don't know, I'm just kind of getting the sense that, is it fair to say that it's hard to manage your investors than like your, let's say, portfolio companies?
To some extent, but, you know, I have about 100 investors in each fund, and you know, there are 100 different reactions. Everybody's different. They know what they're getting into, that I'm going to do the best I can to put together this portfolio. They've interacted with me enough that they know I'm bothered by, I'm putting my money in too. So I have the same result, and they know that things happen. But for the people who are new and haven't made those investments before, that reaction might be different. I manage my mother's modest investment arm, and she's 96. My biggest concern with her is that each month when she gets the statement of what she currently has, that it's bit more than she had the month prior. Because if it's less, I get a call. I'm not putting her into a venture capital fund under any circumstances. It's just not right for her mentality about investing.
Would you, so we spoke about like the stress of the job, but are there like positives? By positives, I mean I'm trying to like understand like on a societal level, like let's say when you're going for like a party or something where you say I manage a fund and suddenly their eyes like kind of dilate or status wise.
People are fascinated by early stage companies, by new technology, I get a lot of questions. You know, what types of companies do you invest in? And there's definitely some status from that. If we were on a Zoom call, the current Zoom background for me is a rocket launch. I invested in a company that's building the next space station, and they sent 4 private astronauts up to the space station last year. And I got to stand there and watch the launch in Florida, and the people standing around me, 2 of them had been to the moon. That's really cool. And when that space station exists and I'll be able to see it, you know, they'll talk about it on all, you know, the space station gets news coverage. You hear about what's going on. It'll be really cool that I had a little part of it. Company cures HIV. There's nothing in my background that would give me the opportunity to be a part of curing HIV other than I wrote them a check. But I'm going to feel pretty proud if that happens. You mentioned nuclear fusion. I invested in a company that is a nuclear fusion company. They're just doing their horrible investment for a lot of venture capital funds because the actual fusion energy is probably still 15, 20 years away. And we're generally 10-year funds, so there's no return there. The company I invested in, it's a 4-stage to energy. They're on stage 2. They're building profitable outcomes as they improve the technology to where they can get viable energy. And the phase 2, they're making radioactive isotopes for medical uses. And one of them is the active ingredient in an oncology treatment that was just released and is doing very, very well, helping people with certain forms of cancer. That feels, it's a great story. I invested in a company that potentially could be making fusion energy, which is, you know, solves a lot of the world's problems, but they're also saving lives right now. A lot of fun. There's great benefits outside of the financial side of to my job. I love my job. I spend most of my time talking to people who are very passionate about the companies they're creating, and in some way they're improving the world in almost every case. It might be they're reducing a tedious part of certain jobs, could be making some things safer. They could be just taking a little bit of money that passes between one party and another, but they're making it go easier so they get a small percentage and that becomes a large amount of money. I'm not as excited about those because you almost feel a little guilty, but they're not drastically changing the world, but they are making, a credit card we talked about earlier. Credit cards, they make money in two ways. One, by charging a huge interest rate if you don't pay your bill on time. There's not a lot of social benefit on that side. And they also, they take 2% of the transaction fee or 3% or whatever it is as it goes through. Not exactly something you want to put up as your big, hey, moral compass. I made this transaction easier, but I took a little bit for just having numbers processed through my circuits. Not really making a huge impact on the world, but good investment.